Good evening. I'm Kilo 2, Kilo... Do that mistake every time. The other guy you're going to hear is Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel, and I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Mel and Dick try to organize this enthusiastic crowd of guys who don't wait for 3 or 4 seconds in between each carrier drop in order to properly reset the machine, but we try to organize this group of people who sign into the technical net, by which they share their information about their favorite hobby, ham radio, and how to make it work better. Lots of education that takes place, we think. Not all of it perfectly accurate, but it eventually gets corrected. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We have some carryovers from last week. We didn't get a chance to get to Joe to B2RYY or Rich into EO. So they're automatically signed in tonight, and they'll be first. Also, there'll be N2XJN, Wesley, who is establishing quite a significant laboratory in Queens that's doing some interesting physics experiments. During the week, you'll probably hear quite a few discussions of some of the really basic laws of physics. What is force? What is energy? What is work? And it's an amazing subject in that quite a few people have a lot of misconceptions in that area. Some of the research Wesley is doing is with reference to machines that have interesting degrees of efficiency. Quite a few articles on YouTube have appeared on that subject, so we'll be discussing some of that. So as I said, we've already got N2EO, WA2RYY, and N2XJN signed in. Anyone else who would like to sign into the TechNet, as I said, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WB2QGZ. Bill and yes with some quick info for the net.
Very fine, Bill. When you say info for the net, I guess we'll... do you want to go in order, or do you think it's sufficiently important that we should put you first?
Well, whatever you prefer. I don't have a question, just a web link here to a online resource from the NTIA, which has about 20 hours of video tutorial on thermal noise, decibel relationships, spectrum analyzer design, kind of from the absolute very beginning all the way through all kinds of noise and interference type scenarios, I guess. So I can go quick or I can wait.
Yeah, give us that email address right now. And how did you discover that one, Bill?
WB10QGZ. I ran into it someplace in a search for something else. And apparently it's only been up for about maybe a month or so, and I guess they're making more. So the URL is http://// videotapes it and was put up here as part of this presentation. So it's
you are the respected technical textbooks, essentially free of charge, and this one from the ITS, giving you all this information about communication technology. We've had some minor discussions on this subject in the past about how far can a signal really go. In other words, when you're talking to a Voyager spacecraft that is now 10 billion miles away, essentially three times the distance of Pluto, how do you get a signal to go that far? What do you do to the receiver to make it receive a signal that's that weak? Because by the inverse square law, as you increase the distance between you and the transmitter, the signal must get weaker by a very predictable law. And how far can you go? That's a slightly controversial subject as to how far can you go. Can you get down to one photon per second? And the answer is absolutely yes. It's being done in the optical world with low-light level cameras. Okay, thank you very much for that information, Bill. And will you have another question later on? Should we put you on a list, Bill?
Not right now. I'm in good shape. But I just want to pass this along. I found it pretty cool. I thought it was a good resource and thought you folks might appreciate it. So thanks, and carry on. WBQ2Z.
By the way, ITS is the Institute for Telecommunications Sciences in Boulder.
Very fine. That was Eric. Eric, are you on the island, or are you in Florida?
No, I'm back home.
I could have some fun with you and say you didn't wait the 4 seconds. What is the recommended wait time on each drop? And one other question, if in my usual long-windedness, if the machine times out as far as the first timer is concerned, and then when we let the carrier drop, we let it drop for a full 4 seconds, does that time out the IRLP, or is even in that first timeout the IRLP requiring resetting? Back to you, Eric.
KQRWK2J. Actually, let me just check here. I do it right now, and I'll give you a response in a minute. In theory, the timer should reset when the tone happens, not when the carrier drops. So, I mean, I used to have it set for when the carrier dropped, the timer would recycle. I figured that would give us some more time, but that didn't work out that way. People would just jump on it, and it kind of helped, but I think we reset it back to when the tone happens, the timer resets. So, give me a second, I'll tell you what the story is. But if you let it drop and wait another 2 to 3 seconds, things should be fine. If the IRLP blows up, I know you're not going to listen to 375 because it's a delay, it'll drive you crazy. But that's one way, one indication of knowing that you've lost it. And again, when the IRLP blows up, the folks that are listening have to dial in again. So there's nothing that we can do about it to reacquire the connection. K2RIWK2J.
One further question I've got there. I have the impression that the IRLP is working through the Eastern machine, 147.375. If the 147.375 is operational, that means the rest of the nation listening to IRLP is connected during the net. Is that one way of being sure? Or is there the possibility that the rest of the IRLP is partially disconnected, even though 375 is repeating what's coming on 85. Over to you, Eric.
Well, if you want to be conscious of who's connected, there is a website that you can go to that will show the status of the connections. And actually, I'm now here. And, yeah, it's the timer starts after the courtesy tone, so after the courtesy tone is when it recycles, so you could figure you want to give it at least 2 seconds after the courtesy tone. But you can now go to status, S-T-A-T-U-S, /IRLP.net, and then click on 9126, and you will see who is connected, which is what I'm going to do right now. And let's see who's visiting us. Also, on Echolink, we actually, if you were to sign in on Echolink, you would see who else is connected, K2RIWK2 again.
Okay, if I understand correctly, www, or maybe no www, maybe just http://, you'll have to give me the first information, are the W's required, then you said status, then you said slash, and then you said dot IRLP. So give us that whole URL one more time, Eric, go ahead.
All right, status, STATUS, dot IRLP dot net, N-E-T. And currently we have, I forget whose call it is, and Bayshore and Glen Oaks and Selden are currently connected. So you can go to status.irlp.net, and if you want to get more complicated, I can give you further, but it's just easy enough to, that's WA2LYY that's logged in there. You can go further and go /index.php and a whole bunch of other stuff, but it's just easy to go to status.irlp.net. You will see a list of reflectors, and you'll type on 9120, and then when you get to that page, scroll down to 9126, and you will see who's connected and what the status is and how long they've been connected for.
Okay. When we're typing in the IRLP URL, status seems to be the first word. Are the W's that precede that, or should we not put the W's? Over to you, Eric.
As with many things, most browsers will accept the fact that you don't have to type in HTTP and :// And actually, most browsers don't care if you type www. If you were going to say you were going to go to IRLP.net, most browsers will allow you to type IRLP.net and then hit return. But in this case, the prefix here is status, S-T-A-T-U-S, no www. So status.irlp.net. That'll get you there.
Good information, and I thank you, Eric. Okay, so far we've got Joe, Rich, and Wesley signed in. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, Paul, with a real question. Yes, Dick.
And good evening all, K2KEY.
KC2UAB, no questions.
K2RLW, Bob, no questions.
Okay, UAP and Bob with a no, Mel and Paul with a yes. Anyone else?
N2RDB, no questions.
WB2IKT with a comment.
Bill, no questions.
Okay, Bill, no questions. IKP with your comment. First, tell me your name, sir.
Okay, Dick, this is Whiskey Bravo 2, India Kilowatt Tango. Name is George, and it's a comment about running the net, and it's just the total number of sessions of the net. Last Sunday I was listening, you mentioned it was 2,000-something. So dividing 2,000-something by 52, and I came up with an improbable number of years that this thing has been going along. If it's been going for 30 years, and I think probably has, we should be in the 1,560 or so area for the number of net sessions that were held, unless it was held more than once a week, or maybe you can enlighten us on that. Thank you. That's my comment.
Very fine, George. Maybe someone gave you the wrong number. The net you're listening to tonight is net number 1,314 of the series that began in September of 1982. If you go to the email, if you go to the URL of Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who's doing this very enthusiastic recording of all the tech nets, you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, with W's in front of that. and you will see the last, I think it's 5 or 6 years of TechNets, every one of them recorded. And the majority of them are documented. In other words, all 4 hours of each Sunday night is there in 4 separate reels of an hour each. And after a couple of weeks have passed, Mike goes back and tells you what took place every 10 minutes or so, so you can go and dial in your favorite subject rather rapidly. On top of that, when it comes to the more general subjects, like how does a Smith chart work, how do decibels work, there's another set of entrance techniques you can use to go directly to those particular discussions. So the last 5 years are recorded. But as I said, 1,314 is the number you're listening to now. Yes, there's 52 of them. I think we average 51 TechNets per year for now 27 and a half years. I guess this is the middle of September. This is the 28th year. This is the month of our 28th year. They began in September of 1982. Okay. Rich, if you're there, I know you had a carryover from last week. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet. And maybe Rich is not there yet. Joe, WA2RYY, you had a question from 1 or 2 weeks ago. And so, now's your chance. What would you like to discuss, Joe? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I don't have the data on the actual question I was going to ask you on. I don't have it presently with me, so I'm going to just ask you something else, which is probably maybe just the, maybe not, the DTV question.
You've got the floor. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, looking recently off the air with a spectrum analyzer, I've noticed that there are still 3 channels coming from New York that have what you would call a scalloped type of pattern as you look at them, with the analyzer set to a dispersion of 1 meg per division per horizontal division, those being RF channel 28, which is WNBC, RF channel 33, which is WCBS, and RF channel 38, which is WOR. My question is, if you're receiving a signal that's borderline, and your decoder is expected to receive the entire signal across that 6 megahertz, I've noticed these scallop type of images that you're looking at from a spectrum analyzer, that between peak signal and actually the valleys, there's a change of about 10 decibels on one channel and up to 15 decibels on other channels. Where does your decoder get the information across those parts of the frequency, which is simply much, much lower in dBm level?
Okay, I'm first going to ask you a couple of questions to make sure I understand the question. Then most likely I'm going to be passing it over to Eric after plugging in a couple of words of my own. My understanding is that if I'm watching a pure digital television broadcast over-the-air signal on a well-adjusted spectrum analyzer connected to a reasonable antenna, I will see what's called a Bartehead display. That is to say, across to, let's assume it was channel 2, because I'm watching that religious channel, which is 54 to 60 megacycles, from 54 and a couple of kilohertz above 54 megs all the way up to 60 megacycles minus a few kilohertz, I would see what looks like broadband noise, and the noise would be fairly flat across that whole almost 6 megacycles. The scalloping that you're seeing with is 10 or 15 dB of peak-to-valley ratio and some number of scallops across the 6 megacycles. It is my belief that that is not what's being broadcast. It is my belief that what you're seeing is a multipath phenomena where you're getting a kind of selective fading. In other words, at those scallop depth areas is where the phase between the direct signal and the indirect signal happens to cancel. And so you get a cancellation at those specific frequencies. So if I understand correctly, at those missing frequencies, assuming now that your signal was not, let me pick a number, 25 dB above threshold, so that the notch of the scallop was not below threshold, I think you're anticipating that if the notches are below threshold of your particular converter, I think you're asking the question, is there enough redundancy in the way the data is sent and enough error correcting that it can plug in the missing data and still continue to give proper demodulation. Is that somewhat, am I on the right frequency, so to speak?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Am I on the right frequency, and that is that essentially your question, Joe? To B2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet?
That is essentially correct, K2RYW. Now you have all the input information, now you can process it.
And if this was a Star Trek program, the computer with a female voice would say, working. Eric, am I correct, do you think, KE2EJ, that the scalloping is a multipath phenomenon, that most likely it is not a broadcast, that's not the signal that is being broadcast from the Empire State Building? And assuming there's a couple of those scalloping notches, or 10 or 15 dB of depth, how in the world does the digital television demodulator figure out what's going on? Is there enough error-correcting code that it can tolerate those notches? Is it almost like a MIMO? And I think the answer is no. MIMO stands for multiple input, multiple output. A protocol that's used for transmitting a certain kind of high-speed data, which is supposedly a lot more tolerant of multipath. KE2EJ, for some further speculations, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric.
K2RW, K2J. You are correct, Dick. Actually, if you were to watch your spectrum analyzer as you rotate your antenna, you'll not only see that scalloping go up and down, but you'll see the entire thing tilt. It has a tendency not to go as you move away towards the direction of transmission, and depending upon where you are and what kind of reflections you're getting, one would assume as the signal gets weaker that that flat line will just simply go up and down. It does not. It actually tilts a little bit. But as far as the receiver's ability to decode that information, there's a lot of redundancy built in. And there is actually error correction at the RF level as opposed to the data level. And that function is a combination of what we call trellis encoding, which is used for over the air. There's a simpler form of trellis, which is used for cable or being in a coaxial cable, which actually allows you to have double the bandwidth. Now it's going to drop. There is Viterbi on the RF portion of the signal before it even actually gets to the actual data itself. Within the data, we have Reed-Solomon. We have something called inner and outer correction, which is a convolution encoding and decoding. And we also have signal randomization, so there's quite a lot going on, and most of today's receivers will tolerate well a lot of scalloping. I think of magnitudes of 15 and 20 dB with the more modern tuners, and you have the ability to continue to decode the symbols as they come in without any detrimental effects to the viewer. K2RIW, K2J.
Fantastic. I'm going to give some further speculations as to what's going on here. Depending on where the multipath object is, say for instance, I've got my antenna aimed at Empire State Building. I'm getting a beautiful direct signal. And a few degrees off to one side is the Dix Hills Water Tower, which is also giving me a very large reflection. Depending on the geometry, you could make believe that there is a bowstring between me and the Empire State Building, and that bowstring represents the direct path. If I now grab the bowstring, let me pick a number, 1 mile from my house, and pull it off to one side so that it now touches the surface of the water tower, the Dix Hills Water Tower, you can easily envision that I have to stretch the string to do that, and that's one way of explaining the extra path length for the signal that bounces off the water tower, in other words, comes straight from Empire to Water Tower, bounces off of it, and then comes to my house. That's obviously a longer path. I had a stretched string, so to speak, compared to the direct path. Depending on the geometry, let me drop. I could have a excess path length of the multipath that is an inch longer, a foot longer, 1,000 feet longer, a mile longer. And at first you'd say, well, okay, if this was ordinary amplitude modulated analog television, I would be getting a ghost image of the delayed signal shifted to the right, and the amount of shifting to the right would represent the extra path length. But we're not using analog television anymore. We're now using this very fancy digital television technique, which spectrally on a good spectrum analyzer should give you a nearly flat spectrum of signal across the whole 6 megacycles. Depending on whether or not that extra path length is a whole lot shorter, a whole lot longer, or only a little bit longer, determines the scalloping rate. The longer the path, the faster the scalloping. What's really going on there is that as I, if I was doing a signal analyzer test from the spectrum, from the Empire State Building, and I slowly swept my signal generator from a low frequency to a high frequency, the rate at which the signal goes through phase at the reception end happens at a different rate for a longer path. I know that's not an easy one to explain, but take my word for it. A longer path has a greater rate of change of phase, or greater DPDF for that path as opposed to the direct path. That tells you the rate at which the signals arriving at my television aerial at my house go in phase and out of phase. Whether in phase you're getting a peak, whether out of phase you're getting a valley. So for a very small difference in path length, that scalloping rate is so slow that you don't even see the valley, because that's falling on the next channel where you're not with
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
If I've got a very small difference in path length, the scalloping rate is by definition very slow, and that first null might occur on the beyond the 6 megacycles of the channel that I'm looking at. Therefore, the net result I will see across the screen is simply a slant in signal strength versus frequency. Correspondingly, if I've got a whole lot of extra path length between me and that water tower versus the direct path, I'm now seeing multiple scallops across the 6 megacycles, maybe one every megacycle, so to speak. That's just for the simple situation of one direct path and one indirect path. Mother Nature's a lot more complicated than that. In the real world, there's always a large number of multipaths. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is each individual one, and how much delay does each individual multipath have. Therefore, you're getting a mixture of slant and scallops really going on simultaneously. And common sense would lead you to believe that if you're analyzing this on paper, doing a theoretical analysis, you would think you would take the power of each one of those paths and add them together at the receiving antenna. Good common sense, dead wrong. Let me drop. One of the things that's not made anywhere near as clear as it should be in the electrical engineering courses that you'll take, and at least I was victimized by this, is that quite often the instructor would say, okay, this represents the signal strength, and we'll call it S. And he doesn't tell you what S stands for. He just says this is S1 for signal number 1, and this is S2 for signal number 1. Well, what kind of a signal is he talking about? Is he talking about the signal in units of decibels? Is he talking about the signal in units of power? Is he talking about the signal in units of voltage? Burn into your mind the fact that Mother Nature, 99% of the time, always thinks in voltage. You may have measured the decibels of dBm on your spectrum analyzer for signal number 1 and signal number 2, and you'd like to just add those together. You can't. You take the decibels and you convert them back to power. You'd like to add them together. You get the wrong answer. You've got to go one step further. You don't do 10 log of P1 over P2. You do 20 log of V1 over V2. Mother Nature thinks in voltage. So take the individual signals, boil them down to individual sinusoidal voltages at some particular magnitude, then add them in a vector manner. sector manner simply means you're adding the magnitude and the phase angle. You do that, and at each individual frequency, if you're smart enough, you can figure out exactly how strong the resultant voltage is of all of those voltage, individual voltage signals being added together, convert that to a power if you like, and then plot that power versus frequency, and you'll get the scalar pattern. So, as I said, the main thing to remember is you have to add all of these things together in voltage. And so, maybe this gives you a little bit of an explanation for what I think is going on, Joe, and I presume you have seen signals that properly get demodulated at your house with numbers like 10 or 15 dB of scalloping peak-to-valley amplitude. I wonder, have you ever seen a sick? Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
All right, I just want to add one thing from the transmitter side that you should be aware of. At the final stages of the transmitter, the signal is passed through a raised cosine filter, and then it goes through typically a Chebyshev mass filter, which in itself generates a little bit of ripple. But we're talking about tenths of a dB, so, you know, it isn't 100% perfectly flat. The pass band of the filter is sort of a little bit rippleless because of the impulse response of it. But, it's just a factor that's in there. So kind of be aware of it because that also adds to the depth of the ripples that you see when you start to deal with, complex multipath. So as much as you explain it, it's absolutely accurate, but then, add a little more ripple to it, it makes it worse.
Yeah, but those become a simple voltage addition phenomenon. If you want to design a filter that's completely flat across the passband, it's called a Butterworth filter, and you can easily remember that one. Butter is smooth, and a Butterworth filter has got a smooth flat top to it. If you want a filter with sharper skirts to it, in other words, the upper rejection region and the lower frequency rejection region, if you want that rejection to occur at a sharper angle, you go to a Chebyshev filter, a Russian design. And now once you've chosen Chebyshev, you can choose a 3 dB Chebyshev, a 1 dB Chebyshev, a 0.1 dB Chebyshev. In other words, depending on which design you choose, you can choose the decibels of peak to valley that will exist across the passband of that filter. The trade-off is you get sharper skirts and better rejection if you accept more ripple in the passband. As you start moving in the direction toward less and less ripple, which really means you're moving toward Butterworth, the skirts are not as sharp, but you get a smoother response across the passband. And that's the trade-off. Can't have it both ways. And I think you're saying that the typical Chebyshev filter used in the final stage of a broadcast transmitter is in the vicinity of 2/10 of a dB of peak-to-valley. Would that be approximately correct, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Actually, it's more like between a half and a tenth. So, it's pretty sharp. The raised cosine filter is very sharp. It actually starts to fall off at the, a little bit at the pilot, but the Chebyshev actually creates the FCC mass. So, it goes down to pretty steep. But the actual ripple that I see displayed is, it's within 1/10 of a dB, and I think there's a specification for it.
Okay, if I understand correctly now, Eric, if the multipath of the environment, in Joe's case, was creating 15 decibels of peak to valley, because of the, I'm going to pick a number, 1/10 of a dB of ripple in the Chebyshev filter of the broadcast transmitter, he sees 15.0 dB of peak to valley. It might be from multipath 14.9 decibels because 1/10 of a decibel was due to the filter, and maybe they just lined up in the worst case situation. Is that approximately the way you see it, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, from my understanding, I agree with you completely. There's actually a whole series of reports here in Gary's book that goes over the factors where actually measures the multipath interference and relating that to
detection threshold. So when you add all the factors together, it really kind of determines, you know, what your coverage area is, and that 1/10 of a dB can actually make or break the line at which you cover. You know, the broadcasters are concerned that they get the maximum coverage, and every little fraction of an oomph is important to them.
Now, in my particular situation, Eric, I'm going to ask you now for a speculation. And before I go there, let me tell you that the conclusion I've had talking to you, being at your place of business, watch you rotate an antenna, see the way a digital television signal gets reception takes place, I'm of the opinion that a serious digital television watcher, if at all possible, would love to have, no matter what he's using for an antenna that's outdoors, he would like to have a rotator on it, because as you rotate the antenna, every real television receiving aerial has got all kinds of peaks and valleys and side lobes and whatever. It's got a complicated pattern. It's trying to cover many octaves of frequency, and as such, it's got a complicated pattern. As you rotate it, those individual fingers of the antenna do and don't favor a particular multipath positions, to particular multipath directions, and therefore for each hour of the day, most likely, there is a most desirable direction you could aim that aerial where you get the best reception of a particular channel. Let me drop. In my particular
case... Can I say something?
I'm going to get there in a minute, Joe. In my particular case, I've chosen a house on high land on Long Island because I knew I was going to be heavily involved in VHF, UHF, ham radio, SHF. As such, I've got line of sight to the Empire State Building. That's good. I've got nearly line of sight to Hartford, Connecticut. Hartford, Connecticut shares some of our channels, and as such, when I watch what's called over-the-air broadcast CBS television on quite a number of days of the year, due to the co-channel interference coming from Hartford simultaneous with the channel from Empire State Building on CBS, I get a complete drop out of the converter. Lots of signal strength is there, but the digital converter will tell me by way of its marquee, that its little bar chart, that it thinks is, because the bit error rate is so high, it thinks there's almost no signal there, and I get very poor reception. I don't have a rotator yet. I'm guessing that the co-channel interference, which really means the poor digital converter is getting two complete independent data streams of nearly the same amplitude, maybe within 10 dB or less, and I'm guessing it gets very confused, can't make sense out of all of that garbage. And if I was looking at it with a spectrum analyzer, I'm guessing that the two co-channels themselves, if there was no multipath, I might not see scalloping. You might have a guess on that one, Eric, then I'm going to turn it over to Joe. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, you know, personally, I haven't really experienced the visual effects of co-channel, except on one occasion, and it was only for a short period of time, so. From what I've read, there would be both cases where there would be some scalloping and not scalloping. Actually, if your receiver had a GPS lock to a synchronous detector, you could possibly, because of the very different delay times in the actual symbols that are being put out, be able to make the receiver tune into one source or the other. Assuming, of course, that both transmitters were GPS locked to the same reference source, and it would just simply be the difference in timing of the symbol. Don't forget, we use pseudo-random number generators to occupy that space where a symbol actually doesn't exist. So, I probably will go along with what you have to say about it. I haven't really experienced it personally. To any extent, we've had issues with Channel 13, and there's a Channel 13 in Pennsylvania when the band was open. We got a little sense of it, but that's pretty much what I got to say about it. K2RW, K2J.
Thank you, Eric. Joe, go right ahead to B2RYY, the guy who started this all off, K2RIW.
Can I have
about 60 seconds to talk.
Why don't you take 3 minutes?
Okay. I see this scout pattern on RF channels 17, 28, 33, and 38. I do not see it on 24, 25, 30, 31, 36, 40, and 44. And no matter how I rotate the antenna in either direction, it does not change the scalar pattern at all, which makes me think it's emanating from the transmitter source. Okay, that's one point. Second point, I see a frequency change between the dips on RF 33. Let's see, I get a peak at 584.7, dip at 585.8, peak at 587.1, and another dip at 588.5. So between the two dips, that's a frequency change of 2.7 megahertz. On channel RF channel 28, which is 554 to 560, between the two dips, which are on slightly different frequencies in relationship to the beginning of the channel, I see a difference of 2.53 megahertz. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, that is strange. First of all, the channels that do give you scalloping and the channels that do not give you scalloping, are all the scallop channels coming from Empire and all the non-scallop channels coming from somewhere else? Or do you have reason to believe that you're getting a mixture of scallop and non-scallop channels from Empire and a mixture of scallop and non-scallop channels from the other source? What do you think on that one, Joe? Over to you, Joe.
I'm not the broadcast engineer. I can't answer that. Let's see. Channel 28, RF 28 is NBC. RF 33 is channels is CBS. And RF 38 is WOR, or WOR. So I don't know where they actually emanate from. The other channels, RF 24 and 25. 24 is NYE. 25 is some other channels. I think a 4 times square I heard that mentioned. RF 30 is one of the Spanish channels. 31 is ION. 36 is another Spanish channel. 40 is another Spanish channel. 44 is WNYW, I think it's called. So I don't know where all these actual RF channels, as far as I know which ones are which, but I don't know where they're actually emanating from. Maybe KE2EJ could shed some light on this. He probably knows better than I do.
And before we turn it over to Eric, one more time, list the channels that do have scalloping, list the channels that do not have scalloping. I understand you are getting scalloping from 28, 33, and 38. Is that true, Joe? Go ahead.
Also getting it from RF 17, and I'm not sure if those come from New York City or something further west than New York City, but I get it on RF 17, RF 28, RF 33, and RF 38. The channels I do not get scalloping on, RF 24, RF 25, RF 30, RF 31, RF 36, RF 40, and RF 44.
How about that? Let's see if Eric's got a guess on this one. You got it, Eric.
All right. 28, 33, and 38 are on the CBS antenna on Empire. It's on the left side of the mooring mast is also the backfill antenna associated with that. RF 24, which is NYE, is coming off of 4 times square. 41 is coming off of 4 times square. 30 ION is coming out of New Jersey. 31 rather. 17 is actually on the 81st floor of Empire on the setback. So you're getting a multitude of stuff. You remember one thing is that if you were asked to take a VNA or did a swept antenna response, you will find that most TV antennas are really not capable of producing a flat response over 6 megahertz. In the days of analog television, nobody could, because you're really only interested in two frequencies, the picture carrier and the sound carrier. And if you look at the response of the antennas, they were kind of optimized, because these are log periodic, they're not single channel antennas designed to pick up 6 megahertz of one frequency, they were designed to pick up the entire broadcast band. So Some of the changes in antenna technology hasn't changed yet. There has been recently some work done on Empire X-ray. I think if I look at my emails, I think last week they were on the standby antennas because they were doing work on the CBS antenna. They had problems with the power divider and a few other things. So I'm not going to say that the scalloping isn't coming from the transmitter based on knowing that there's some work done, but, you know, actually, getting 10 minutes, I can...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, yeah. During the timeout, Eric said, more than likely, some of the scalloping you're seeing is due to your receiving antenna. Now, the transmitter itself, it's a Chebyshev filter and whatever, and its degree of flatness, when measured into a 50-ohm high-power dummy load, that transmitter has certain guaranteed performance by the manufacturer of that television digital transmitter. With the current hardware in its state of flux where it's being modified, in other words, the main broadcast used to be World Trade Center, and now under emergency conditions, so to speak, we're back at Empire State Building. Is there a significant possibility here, Eric, that Joe has discovered that the currently used antenna is creating a significant portion of the scalloping he is seeing? And if so, if the currently used antenna is creating some amount of that scalloping, is that scalloping one of the aggravating factors that possibly is making over-the-air television broadcast a bit more difficult for some of the viewers? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, if you remember a bunch of months back, we were talking about, I had done some surveys when they had the backfill antenna on, when they had the backfill antenna off, and that, of course, did actually create some measurable issues, but not in terms of scalloping. But anyway, even if there was a couple of dB of stuff coming out, it isn't going to really significantly bother the receivers.
Well, let's backtrack for a second now. If I'm using a backfill antenna, which has a slightly different path length from the transmitter as opposed to the main antenna, because of those differences in path length, yes, it's giving a slightly more complicated antenna pattern, but it's giving a complicated antenna pattern as a function of frequency. As such, it is what the radar people would call the frequency-scanned antenna. Is there the possibility that the little bit of signal he's getting from the backfill could be an aggravating factor? Let me show you an example of this. If I had two signals being combined, because it's a voltage combined, not a power combined, the weaker signal could be something like 27 decibels weaker. That will give me either half or 1 dB of peak to valley of scalloping across that band. To remove scalloping entirely would require that the backfill antenna at his QTH to be giving him a signal that's 30 some odd dB weaker than the main antenna. That's a very stiff requirement. So is it possible to backfill the antenna itself, the main broadcast antenna, probably is pretty flat, but the backfill function could be one of the causes of agents. What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Well, I'm guessing he's located somewhere in Bayshore. Is that correct?
Yeah, he's on the South Shore in, I think it's Sayville. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I've seen the patterns. There's no way in heck that that's going to have any effect on him. The effect is my antenna is tilted downwards, tilted to Brooklyn. It's not going to have any effect on him way out there.
Okay. Has anyone at any location, far, near, whatever, looked with a spectrum analyzer as to the flatness, whether or not scalloping exists across the broadcast of the power flux density across the 6 megacycle band? Has that been viewed in your to your knowledge, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's been lots of surveys and studies done. Actually, in that big thick book that I gave you, There is even some pictures of New York TV stations and TV stations in other parts of the country showing the actual effects, including signal strength and multipath. So, K2RW, K2J.
Hello? K2RY.
Okay. As I see it, Joe, I think you're onto something rather interesting here. What's the real causative agent? Is it occurring at the source? Is it occurring somewhere between the source and you? The fact that some of those channels from essentially the same area, as far as you're concerned, don't show the scalloping is more than curious. I think you're onto something here, Joe.
They're different antennas, Dick.
Understand. But still, what is the real causative agent of what he's saying? I don't think it's the calibration of his spectrum analyzer, because that could be confirmed. Whether or not his individual antenna is doing it on that channel is something interesting. My multipath philosophy, my multipath speculation hypothesis is almost going out the window when he sees the exact same scalloping as he rotates the antenna. That blows an awful big hole in that theory. I think you're onto something here, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay, Dick, I want you to copy down these frequencies. I saw on RF channel 33, I saw a peak signal relatively about 584.7. I saw a dip at 585.8. Another peak at 587.1, a dip at 588.5, and another peak at 589.4. Okay, you got those frequencies written down?
Yes, go ahead.
Give me some more frequencies to put in your R7000 radio. Between 554 to 560. 554.5, I see a relative peak. 555.18, I see a relative dip. 556.42 is a relative peak. 557.71, relative dip. 559.12 is a peak. I have checked this type of pattern with a spectrum analyzer, two different analyzers on two different antennas. I checked my monitor antenna, which is relatively flat up into the UHF part of the band. So blaming my antenna is not the answer. My antenna is not the fault. I believe this really is coming from your transmitter site. And I can confirm this by listening to the monitor antenna with the R7000. Even though it's a very narrow band type of receiver, it will give you an S-meter indication of the broadband noise it's receiving within its bandwidth, and as you scan across the frequency, you will watch your S-meter go up and down as you hit these dips and these peaks. Try it, K2RAW, and you'll agree with me.
Okay, fascinating. The fact that you're using more than one antenna and more than one receiving device, and on the exact same frequencies you see the peaks and the valleys, that blows a hole in multipath, or at least usual multipath, unless it's very narrow frequency region. In other words, multipath that's only coming from plus or minus 3 degrees of boresight. So different antennas, different receiving sites, receiving antennas, different measuring instrumentation sees the exact same peaks and valleys. My antenna that's connected to my R7000 is working so poorly, it might not even have the ability to get those signals above thresholds to where I can confirm them. I got to repair that antenna. So I'm going to try to look into that when I get a chance. Let's see, I've got a better antenna. Yeah, the television aerial I use on the main set in the living room, I can connect to that. Okay, beautiful stuff, Joe. Thank you, and keep us posted as to what you find out. One more call to Rich, see if he's available. N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW there. You there, Rich? Looks like he's not. And let me give a quick call to Mel. Mel, before we go to the next subject, which I know is going to be a little bit lengthy, just like the last one was, I think we should try for at least one of your email responses right now before it gets late, because the youngsters that are in the process of getting their ham license aren't allowed to stay up real late. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
We're dwelling a little too long again on one particular subject. Let's see. Yeah, let me pick one out here. Here's one that should be fairly quick. Last week, they thanked us for that discussion that we did on resonance. And now the question is, which tuner should we use? We see in the manual, the antenna manual, they mention different types of tuners, such as T, Pi, L, and automatic tuners. Which tuners do you think is the ideal tuner to go with? You know, they show a number of course different designs. So, generally speaking, which antenna tuner would you prefer to pick for an average dipole? Over.
Well, but let me drop long enough. The question is almost like the question of would I be happier if I married a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead, or a lady with brown hair? Would I be happier if I marry a lady that's tall, short, fat, skinny, whatever? Each of those individual ladies have got individual advantages and disadvantages. Each of those individual kinds of tuner, T, Pi, L, and combinations of them, have various regions of the Smith chart that they can cover, different amounts of efficiency. The best possible tuner would probably be a combination like Pi, L, where you now have more knobs, so to speak, therefore you can cover a greater amount of real estate of the Smith chart. The Smith chart, a properly calibrated Smith chart, in theory occupies or encompasses every possible impedance, all possible amounts of reactance from minus infinity to plus infinity, and all possible resistive components from zero to infinity in ohms. And so that's your whole Smith chart, all of the area. And if this is the best of all worlds, the antenna tuner I would use would cover all of that area, have no insertion loss, be affordable in dollars, and be reasonable in size. Well, that particular combination is like asking for an Einstein brain inside of a Raquel Welch body, to put it in the old terms, if you know what I mean. You just don't get that combination. It's a compromise everywhere. You're the guy I know who has done the most amount of real construction of antenna tuners. And if I know you, Mel, you would go through your junk box and all of the pieces of equipment you're willing to cannibalize. Let me drop. And you would choose the best possible great big air variable capacitors that can take a kilowatt without arcing over, the best roller ductors and whatever. So, in theory, to you, cost was no object, size was no object. You wanted performance because you wanted all possible tuning characteristics of the antenna tuner you used with your open wire feed line to your full full loop antenna, 270 feet long, roughly on 80 meters. So how did you choose, Mel, what kind of an antenna tuner you were going to design and build? And after you did design it and build it, I'm guessing that if someone wanted to duplicate it, he might have to write a fairly big check. He might have to get himself a fairly large box. You wanted performance. The size of the box probably didn't matter as much to you. And because you had the available parts, you didn't have to buy. The dollars didn't matter to you. And when it comes to reading the rating charts for each of the available antenna tuners, automatic or manual, they come all kinds of prices and sizes and performances. So sort of like choosing the best possible transmitter. I know it's not easy. What did you do on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, I'm a firm believer that you do need a tuner. And basically, I've got quite a number of them. Everything from commercial to sophisticated homebrew, which I spent enough money on to literally buy above any commercial tuner that's available. What I went ahead and got involved with when I tried to really go all the way with it. The problem is, you see, it was talking about, again, I don't want to mention that about bronze and brunettes and redheads, but the redhead sitting here is giving me, she gives me a very sarcastic look when you use that terminology,